With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Lord's Cricket Podcast. An Ashes special.
Well, welcome along to this Ashes podcast special brought to you from the Lord's Pavilion in association with Wisden Cricket Monthly. I'm your host, Will Rowe, and in this episode, Botham's Ashes, we look at how one of the most iconic cricket series of all time unfolded in the English summer of 1981. From the depths of despair at Lord's to the highs of Headingley, it was a roller coaster 6-week period that captured the nation's attentions quite like no other Test series did before and maybe since. To look back at the key moments and tell the story of one of England's greatest Ashes series, I'm joined in the Lord's long room by one of the main protagonists that summer, former England fast bowler Bob Willis. Welcome, Bob.
Hi.
Nice to have you along. And alongside Bob, editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. Welcome, Phil.
Hi, Will.
Great stuff. Well, we're here in the long room, quite a room to be recording this podcast in. I think let's take everyone back to 1981. What was going on in that summer, Bob?
Well, for the England cricket team, it was a tumultuous time, as it was in the country in general. Political unrest, strikes going on, people feeling pretty low, with only the sort of royal wedding to look forward to lift their spirits. England had a rough time in the West Indies, not steamrolled quite as badly as they were on their following tour under David Gower, but the team was optimistic, having weathered the West Indies storm and coming into the English summer. The Aussies usually bring out the best in England's team. So we were in pretty high spirits when we got to Trent Bridge.
When the Australians arrived, it was sort of the strongest Australian side for a while because the previous couple of Ashes series, there'd been the Kerry Packer and World Series cricket. As a side, how confident were you going into 81?
Yeah, well, Australia had a few problems. They had massive problems in 1977 when the Packer story broke, when Greg Chappell was the captain, and sort of half the team had signed up to World Series cricket and the other half hadn't. So they divided into two factions. In 1981, they were unified again, and the unified team had smashed England 3-0 in a short non-Ashes series in Australia in 79-80. But there were problems about the captaincy. Kim Hughes, who stayed loyal to the establishment cricket and hadn't played for Kerry Packer, had two thorny old characters, Rod Marsh and Dennis Lilly, under his tutelage, if you like, and it didn't work out too well. So there were chinks in the Aussie armour, but on paper, a very strong side.
Kim Hughes it doesn't quite fit in with the archetype of the Australian tough, hard-nosed, heavy-drinking cricketer of the time. And I think, having read around that time, he never quite broke the connection between Marsh and Lilly. And there was the Western Australia element as well. Lilly was 3 years older than Kim Hughes. Kim Hughes was the new kid on the block down in Perth, and Lilly went after him. And I think there was an alpha element to their relationship. And I think Hughes was around 24, 25 when he was in charge over here in 81. And even though he was renowned as a glorious player on his day,
yeah,
he was a kind of a fragile cricketer whose average really kind of belied his ability overall, and was famously jacked in the captaincy in 84 in tears against the West Indies. And that was almost his legacy, really, not just the 81 summer, but then resigning in tears against West Indies 2 or 3 years later. And he wasn't helped out by the senior men on that tour that summer.
No, he wasn't. I guess when Australia went one up at Trent Bridge, they thought it was going to be a bit of a cakewalk. And the problems didn't really arise until things started going against them and the tide turned. But there was definitely an undercurrent in the team. I think England had patched up all the differences between Packer players and non-Packer players. I mean, it's difficult to explain how unpleasant it was in county dressing rooms around the country when players were playing with people who'd signed up for Packer. They really were outcasts. I can remember at Warwickshire, hardly anybody was speaking to Dennis Amos during the summer of 1978, so after the first Australian summer of World Series cricket.
Were there any Packer players in the England side in 81?
I'm trying to think back. The team changed so often in 1981, although it was a winning series. I think the team changed every time.
Mm-hmm. Just looking at that first Test match, Trent Bridge, Botham said at the time, if we'd caught our catches, we'd have fancied that we'd have won that game. Is that your recollection?
Very much so, yes.
How many did they grass off your bowling?
Well, there were plenty. There were plenty of everybody's bowling from memory. Clearly, Ian was distracted by this ridiculous policy of naming the captain test by test match. Can you imagine that happening these days? You were appointed for one test match at a time. But certainly, as we've seen in more recent times, catches going down can alter not only the result of one test match, but the outcome of a whole series. And England certainly did have butterfingers at Trent Bridge. And it was a close match, and England could have won it if they'd caught better.
There's so many ifs and buts in this series that we're going to come on to. It's an absolute roller coaster. That first test match, Australia come away, they knock off 132 in the final final innings to win, you know, with 6 wickets down. So it's a 4-wicket victory, as you say, Bob. Plenty of catches went down. England could have won that. Then the story moves to Lords. A bit of a damp squib of a test match. Quite a few tests in around that time at Lords weren't that good. The umpires came off a bad light when they shouldn't have done. It was rain affected. And it plays out for a draw. But the story at this point is Botham's captaincy is under fire. There was even this bizarre thing. I was doing my research on BBC Newsnight. They actually had a prosecution against Ian Botham. To think now that you'd have such a thing on an English captain on BBC Two with Paxman or whoever it is that presents it these days. But if you could sort of pick up the story at Lord's, Bob, it's that moment where... What was it like in the dressing room with the pressure on Ian? You must have... As players, you must have felt it.
Yeah, well, we felt, chance had slipped through our fingers at Trent Bridge. 4-wicket victory sounds more convincing than it actually was, I think. And as you say, weather, bad light, fairly damp and dingy conditions. And you could feel that the pressure was mounting because the press had really got stuck into the side, and Ian in particular. The press corps had been in the West Indies and witnessed at first hand Ian's aversion to nets. And in those days, there wasn't a whole host of backup staff. So basically the captain was in charge of organising the net practice. And a little bit like David Gower on the following tour to the West Indies, nets were anathema to these guys. They hated nets. So organising it for other people was not a strong point. And the press noticed this. So often they were expecting the side to be seen to be doing the right thing, although completely outgunned by the West Indies at every turn. You know, they were meant to be practising hard and not being pictured on the beach or with a beer in their hand or a girl on their arm. So the tom-toms were certainly pounding in the press corps, and they were after blood. And, of course, they eventually got it after the Lord's Test.
And it was at that test match, the infamous now moment where in the final innings, both of them bags a pair. He's bowled by Ray Bright around his legs, trying to go for quick runs, but the test is all but over. So it's this narrative starts to develop where everyone's focusing on both of them. And then it's one of the most famous walks back, one of the most famous walk back from the Lord's middle for all the wrong reasons.
Well,
you were 6 months old at the time, Phil. What do you remember?
All right, hold on. I was a year and a half.
A year and a half.
Well, firstly, my nan bought me a VHS of Botham's Ashes when I was 6 years old, and it's not exaggerating to say that my hopeless devotion to this game began with that video. And so I, for my sins, know literally every line from it, literally every scorecard from it as well. And as Botham's walking back that afternoon, and you rightly say he was going for quick runs, he was playing selflessly, as of course he always did, and Tony Lewis, the great old Welsh commentator, former England captain, he simply kind of mutters under his breath, "Returns to silence," as he walks through the long room. And the MCC members, whose ghosts drift through this morning as we sit here in the long room, they were all studiously reading their telegraphs and their times. There weren't too many Guardians in there, I wouldn't have thought at the time. And both of them walked through to this kind of deafening silence. And it's fair to say, Bob, that he didn't take to that too well.
No, he didn't. He had a hate-hate relationship with MCC at that time. Fortunately, as the years unfolded, it got much better. And I remember the MCC putting on a splendid party for Ian when he was quite rightly knighted much later in his life. But, yeah, as you say, heads were bowed. I don't think people are expecting thunderous applause if someone gets a duck or indeed a pair, but they were sort of turning their heads away and, in rather distasteful manner. And I think that was certainly some of the reason why Ian decided to throw in the towel at the end of the match. There's a lot of controversy about what actually went on at the conclusion of the game, and I think Alec Bedser was rather foolish to tell the press afterwards, well, yes, Ian did resign, but I was going to sack him anyway. I mean, what that does to the individual's morale and the team spirit of the side is anyone's guess, but it was a pretty grim time for Ian. I can remember him getting into his car and driving out here, and there must have been an enormous burden on his mind.
Can I just ask you briefly, albeit from quite a small sample size, what style of captain was Botham? Admittedly, against the all-conquering West Indies predominantly at the time.
Well, he wanted people to express themselves. There weren't many Churchillian speeches. I think the thing that Ian didn't understand was a lot of people did need motivation and reassurance, which, of course, Beefy never did. Pull on your England sweater and you're representing your country. Go out there and I'm going to take on the world. But, lesser mortals needed a hand on the shoulder, which Ian wasn't particularly gifted at.
He was also very young at the time, wasn't he?
Well, yes, it was Brian Close's selection to make Ian captain, and Ian had learned a lot about the game from Closey down at Somerset. And Botham always had a very, very keen cricketing brain, but not the ideal attributes to be a captain. Yes, on the field he knew what was going on, where to place the field, but it was off the field and, as I say, organising practice or attending press conferences or to be seen to be doing the right thing off the field did not come easily to Ian. So he wasn't the right man for the job at that time. Mm-hmm. He might have been in 4 or 5 years' time.
Mm. In the chaos of the post-Lords resignation stroke sacking, etc. Botham was interviewed, and he was asked by Peter West, who presented the BBC's stuff at the time, he said, who should take over from you? And he said, well, in my opinion, the most well-equipped captain out there is Mike Brearley. So Botham was quite prescient, let's say, on that. He identified that that's what the team needed post his own captaincy era. And obviously, the rest is history.
Time for a short ad break now, and when we come back, we'll pick up the story with the test match that changed the summer, Headingley.
The first issue of Wisden Cricket Monthly, an Ashes special, is in shops now. To subscribe and save over £20, go to wisdomsubs.com/ashes.
Right, to begin the second half of this podcast, we start with a short interview clip from Mike Brearley. Recalled to the side as captain, having retired the year before, Brearley was effectively parachuted in a gamble that would pay off as England turned the series around in dramatic fashion. But hindsight is a beautiful thing, and when I caught up with Mike earlier this year, I asked him how he felt coming back into the side with a star player whose pride was wounded after losing the captaincy, and a strike bowler who appeared unfit just days before that crucial third test.
Well, I was excited, of course, but I was also a bit nervous, and one of the things that made me nervous was how would it be with Ian in particular. And I think I was also uneasy with Bob, because it wasn't so much that he was ageing. After all, he had several years more playing for England after that. But he hadn't been well. He'd had chest infections. He was running in and bowling no balls. He had lost his spearhead role. Graham Dilley had come into the side. And there was a big question whether Dilley should open the bowling with Botham rather than Willis. And so I think he was quite unsure and not really fully fit, and we at first didn't pick him for the Headingley test. You know, we gathered he wasn't fully fit, and then we heard, luckily before we'd announced the team, I mean this was really rather shocking, we heard before we'd announced the team that he was fit, and we said, well, all right then, you better play for the second 11 or the 40 over match and bowl your allotted overs and bowl for a good couple of spells and make sure in a match you're fully fit, you're running in well and you feel all right. So we did that and we picked him and he played. But he was that close to not playing.
It seems crazy to think, Bob, that you almost didn't play in that famous third test at Headingley.
Yes, it was quite bizarre, really. Warwickshire were playing Surrey at the Oval in the match between the tests, and I'd, as Mike said, had a chest infection during the Lord's Test match, and I missed the county match. And Alec Betzer rang me up and said, I'm sorry, Bob, you haven't been picked for the test match, but Mike, the new captain, wants everybody 100% fit. And I said, Alec, the only reason I'm not playing in this match is so that I'd be fit for Thursday and 100% for the Headingley Test match. So I managed to persuade Alec that I could play in a one-day game for Warwickshire's second 11. Alec agreed to this, and he rang up Major Carr, who was the secretary of Derbyshire, and he intercepted Mike Hendricks' invitation to play in the match. That's how archaic things were. As recently as 1981, Alec Betzer would get his inkwell and quill pen out and handwrite invitations to the players, and at the bottom, did you want to accept the fee for playing, that sort of thing. And so Mike didn't get his invitation, so I headed from Birmingham up to Leeds for the Nets on the Wednesday before the test match. But it was a close run thing whether I was going to get picked or not. And I suppose when Australia made 401 for 9 declared, they wondered whether they'd made the right decision.
Botham tells a story about this, that the day before the game's due to commence, Brearley comes up to him and says, how are you feeling? And obviously Beefy being Beefy said, yeah, I'm feeling good. He said, you sure you want to play this one? And he said, well, yeah, of course I do. And then there was a pause, and then Brearley said, OK, I think you're going to get 200 runs and 10 wickets. And then he kind of walks away with a smile. So if we're talking about the kind of subtle dynamics of power, very clever work by Brearley straight away. To firstly sting both of them, I suppose, into focusing on the here and now, forgetting what's gone in previous weeks.
Yeah.
And then, having stung him, then the praise comes after that. You know, very subtle little plays, as ever. But Brearley, of course, famously, as Rodney Hogg said, had a degree in people.
He learned captaincy the hard way, because he came into a very dysfunctional, although very experienced, Middlesex dressing room as captain, and the old soaks like Eric Russell and Peter Parfitt and John Murray and Fred Titmuss, they were the senior cabal at Middlesex, and Brearley had to sort of break this up and get these old pros performing for the team. And both at county level, at international level, Mike had to suffer this sort of undercurrent. Well, he's not really very good as a batsman, is he? Is he worth his place in the side? Clearly he was at Middlesex. But when it came to England selection, there was certainly always a question mark about Brearley's place in the side on merit as a batsman. But in terms of managing his team, I can't think of anybody who got anywhere near him as being able to get the best out of the people under him.
Well, both of them plays at Headingley. He's in the side. Bob, you just make the side. But things don't go very well. Brearley loses the toss. Australia 401 for 9 declared. England are bowled out for 174. So even at Headingley, things are going wrong. It's a turnaround within a turnaround. This is quite a miraculous test match. And then England are 105 for 5 following on. And then it's the famous Botham innings. For those that don't know it, it's where he comes out and just slaps 149 not out.
Yeah, well, just to rewind, just very, very, very briefly.
Of course.
End of day three, England were 0-1 following on, because Gucci had nicked off, I think, or probably LBW, I'd have thought, to Alderman, in the last minutes of day three. And famously, most of the England boys, I don't know if you did, Bob, but everyone else checked out of the hotel, assuming that day four would be the final day of that game. And was the rest day between day three and four? Was that right?
That's right, yes. I mean, in those days...
So it's a biggie for a party, naturally enough.
Yeah. the older members of the side, I think, were considering the notes for their epitaph during the game. And there's always this sort of reverse sense of humour about what's going to happen. You've got a character like Peter Willey in the side with his... downtrodden look and dark humour, and one or two of us joined in with that. But the infamous barbecue at Ian's was an amazing affair, really. He was living in the Humberside village of Epworth in those days, not that far away from Headingley, and the Australian team bus turned up with a whole touring party, and a great time was had by all. I mean, I don't think that sort of thing happens anymore, which is a great shame.
Yeah.
Although the sides were locking horns on the field and fearsome rivalry on the field, off the field, beers were shared and anecdotes passed from one to the other. And a great time was had by all.
But this was a party mid-test. This was
during the test match. Oh, yes.
Went to Ian's house at Humberside.
I mean, it was probably apposite that Joe Root denied that there was a drinking culture in the current England side of 2017. I think to a certain extent, apart from Brearley, there probably was a drinking culture in the 1981 team. And we... even after a day's play, we would decamp, probably in our England ties and blazers, to the local pub and down pints, not necessarily with the opposition, but together during the game. I mean,
It was ever thus. I was reading about the Timeless Test 1939, Wally Hammer's tour of South Africa, and the boys enjoyed themselves. There's no two ways about it. Bill Edrich, a legend of this place here, would be regularly poked and woken up, you know, half an hour or so before he's got to be down at the ground. And that was how he chose to get the best out of himself. It's funny how these stories continue to repeat themselves. You know, the Ben Stokes story as well, the England drinking culture, so-called or otherwise. This is the way that cricket has always been, Bob, right?
Well, one hopes so, in a way. I mean, the side is obviously more professional these days, but the cure for the hangover after the Botham barbecue on the Saturday night was not a few Alka-Seltzer and then back to Leeds. It was straight into the Queen's Head in Epworth for a few reviving pints when the pub opened at 12 o'clock. But, yes, so the bags were packed on the Monday morning, as everybody thought that England would be rolled over by mid-afternoon. And not only would England be 2-0 down, but a few test careers would be assigned, if you'll forgive the pun, to the Ashes. And that's really what the feeling was when we got back to the ground at Headingley, and perhaps the magician's magic from Brearley hadn't quite worked this time.
At that point, 105 for 5, I think it was, still way behind on second innings.
Well, they were 100, I mean, they were still just trying to avoid an innings defeat at this point.
And then that quickly became 130 for 7, so they were 90-odd behind, just forcing Australia to bat again, when, of course, Graham Dilley, who was a young quick and a kind of punchy game number nine, number 10, with a good eye for a ball. He came out to bat with no test match pedigree whatsoever and played Bob out of his skin.
He certainly did, and it was Ian, in his inimitable style, made Graham relax. The Botham innings had started fairly strangely. Basically, Ian just started having a slog and some great shots in amongst some edges over the slips and through the gaps in the cordon behind the wicket. And it was really at this time where the cracks in the relationship between Hughes and Marsh and Lilly really opened up and splintered, because Marsh and Lilly couldn't believe what Hughes was doing. He kept bowling the quicks, thinking that Botham was going to edge a ball into the slips. But, of course, the force of the swing of Ian's bat took any edges over the slips to third man, and if they pitched it up, he crashed it through extra cover. The argument started on the field as Botham's innings progressed, and then he started playing absolutely brilliantly and, of course, inspired first Dilley and then Chris Auld, who made an important contribution as well. But it was a marvellous sight watching this very experienced and highly skilled Australian pace attack being absolutely taken to pieces by Botham.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And whilst this is going on, there's also the the now infamous Aussie bet, the 500-1. I think Ladbrokes offered that before England's final innings, England to win the match, and Lillian Marsh took the bet. I think it's Peter Geezer-Tribe, who was the Australian coach driver. He went and put the bet on for them. So he had all this going on, which is another bizarre twist of fate. Not to do away from the cricket, but I think also Bob Taylor tried to get a bet on, but couldn't do it because he got stung by autograph hunters.
That right? I didn't know that about Bob.
Yeah. Well, dear old Godfrey Evans was the Ladbrokes consultant at that time. I mean, nowadays, no actual professional bookmaker in a two-horse race would ever offer odds of 500-1. We know that the Aussies would bet on two flies crawling up the wall, or their very sophisticated game called two-up, which became Jeff Thompson's nickname in Australia, where you throw two coins on the ground and you've got to guess whether they're going to come up two heads, two tails, or one of each. I mean, it that takes a lot of brain power to sort that out. But yeah, Marsh and Lily got their bet on, but I don't think even in those days there would have been a huge ICC and Scotland Yard investigation into them throwing the match.
No, not for a moment was I suggesting the match was thrown, but it's just this funny little backstory, and also that poor Bob Taylor just couldn't get round to get his bet on because
that would have sorted him out post-career.
Well, autograph hunters came, and bless him, he couldn't get to the tent in time and was called back to a team meeting.
Bob Taylor, such a nice guy, would never deny anybody an autograph, even if it meant missing out on a winning bet.
And then Australia is, and then still, even after Ian's heroics of 149 not out, Australia is set just 130 to win. So now the game's going to the wire. The public is starting to get excited. I mean, we talked earlier about there was a recession on. It wasn't a great time in England in the summer of 81. But suddenly the nation is being captivated by this game. And then this is your famous moment, Bob, where you take 8 wickets to win the match.
Yep. England had rather strangled out Graham Wood early in the piece. He was a little bit... Botham never got really tired, but he was perhaps a little bit fatigued by his efforts with the bat. And as Mike Brearley mentioned earlier, Graham Dilley was the rising force, and as today, swing was the big thing against touring sides coming to England. So it was Botham and Dilley who took the new ball. And apart from the dismissal of Wood, I think Australia got to 52 for one.
Yep.
I was the fourth England bowler used. And I'd started bowling up the hill from the football stand end. I don't think... Mike was a little bit concerned about this no ball problem I had and thought if I bowled down the hill I'd be overstepping all the time. But I said to him, I think I'm a little bit old and long in the tooth to be bowling up this hill into the breeze. Better have a go down the hill. So then we picked up the 3 wickets in quick succession.
And that was just before lunch, is
that
right?
That's right, yeah.
So it changes the complexion of it, I guess.
Very much so. The brilliant catch, Botham caught Kim Hughes. Trevor Chappell got a brute of a ball which leapt from quite a good length. And
Gatting at short leg.
And Graham Yallop was caught by Gatting at short leg trying to evade another short pitch delivery. So you could feel the pressure of the situation going from us to the Australians, and having been 52 for one to then being 4 down, with still some way to go to knock off the winning runs, we had a complete change of heart about the outcome of this contest.
And then you come out in the afternoon and you're running down the hill from the Kirkstall Lane end.
Yep, and some more very fine catches. John Dyson went for a hook and gloved the ball through to Bob Taylor. And then the famous Dilley catch on the boundary with Rod Marsh going for a pool shot. And then there was an innovative innings from Dennis Lilly, who inched Australia closer to the target, hit it into the leg side and picked up a few boundaries. And then another pitched-up delivery. He tried to clip wide of Gatting at mid-on, and Mike, sensing it might have been a pork pie, dived forward and took another tumbling catch. So the catching, which had been so fragile and disappointing at Trent Bridge just a couple of test matches earlier, was transformed, and everything was sticking.
What was going through your mind at the time? Because the footage is compelling. You are in your own world.
In
You're
the zone.
You're almost zombified, you know. And it's astounding to watch. What was it? Can you remember?
I didn't want any distractions from celebrations or field changings. Mike was in charge of setting the field. I was just totally focused on reproducing the type of delivery that had been successful a ball or a few balls earlier. So I just wanted to march back to my mark, completely focused, not be distracted by anything. And that's how it worked out. And Mike said, forget about overstepping, just come in. The pitch was deteriorating fast. And, of course, the icing on the cake was Ray Bright's middle stump cartwheeling out of the ground. And that is probably the moment that I'll take to the grave.
And that is the moment where the series swings in the space of a few weeks. England beaten at Trent Bridge, both of them walking off here at Lord's through the long room in disgrace. And then suddenly at Headingley you have this amazing game and it turns around. And you took 8 for 43 in that final innings, Bob, and you still weren't man of the match.
Well, Fred Truman was the adjudicator, so Fred would never give the man of the match to a bowler because none of them were ever as good as him. But, the 8 for 43 wouldn't have happened without Botham's innings. And maybe there was a case because it was a match-winning bowling performance for me getting the man of the match award there. But
I'm going to go for you on the case. Partnership of 37 as well, Bob, at the end. Now, admittedly, you only contributed two of those with Beefy, but still, without that 37 partnership for the 10th wicket, you know, you wouldn't have had a target with which to bowl at.
That's exactly right. I keep underlining how important those two runs were and the partnership with Ian. He must have got most of the other 35. I don't know how many were extras amongst that, but I did manage to hold out for a while he... increased our lead from under 100 to the 129 that it turned out in the end. But, I sort of spiralled off the field and sprinted to the dressing room as the crowd ran onto the pitch. I think I've met 250,000 people who said they were at the game. And the sad thing was that... In those days, of course, there was another important county fixture the next day. I think it was the second round of the Gillette Cup. So by the time Botham, Willis and Brearley had done the TV interviews and the radio interviews and gone to the press conference, we came back to the dressing room. And although the champagne had been transferred from the Australian bath to England's bath, there wasn't anybody left to celebrate. Everybody had packed up and gone off to their county match. So I can remember just having a pint in the dressing room with Ian. I think he was famously photographed with a cigar in his mouth and perhaps a pint of bitter. And that was all the celebration was. So it was a great shame that there wasn't any open-top bus ride through the centre of Leeds to... celebrate that incredible match. But of course, what might have been Botham and Willis's ashes, that was all dashed when Ian's heroics at Old Trafford and Edgbaston, an actual better century at Old Trafford than at Headingley, and then of course a spell of 5 for 1 at Edgbaston to win that test match as well, where Hughes's captaincy ended in tears in Brisbane, I think, against the West Indies, a few years later, but he was pretty close to tears at Edgbaston trying to explain away another Aussie
batting
collapse.
Lightning striking twice. That's what's astonishing about this series, that they were chasing 130 to win at Headingley and they were chasing 150-something at Edgbaston a week
151 it was, 151, yeah.
Oh, I need to do my research.
It's written in front of you, Phil.
Yeah, sure, sure. And again, just as they were 50-odd for one at Headingley, needing 80 and obviously collapsed there, similar things were happening at Edgbaston as well. They got off to a reasonably good start, didn't they? And they were kind of 50-odd needed with about six wickets in hand. And I think Brearley turns to both of them and he says, do you fancy it? And he says, well, I think we should bowl Peter Willey because it's turning a little bit. And then Brearley says, I think you might want to have a go.
But at this point, you know, Ian is inspired and the sort of the tide has just turned now. The Edgbaston test, there's also been a royal wedding in between Headingley and Edgbaston. So suddenly the country's come alive and suddenly it's a great summer.
Yeah, I don't think any other sporting event in the summer, obviously World Cup winning soccer is a bit different, but in the summer the Ashes does focus everybody's attention, and even if England end up losing Ashes series, unlike Australia where the Australians desert their team if they're losing at home, people have bought tickets in advance for our smaller cricket grounds here, and even towards the end of the series, the grounds are always packed for these contests. So for England to be on the brink of turning round the whole series in those later matches caught everybody's imaginations. And people, there was high unemployment, and the Thatcher government was probably at its most unpopular at that time. It certainly, along with the wedding, gave everybody a huge lift. And although the final test match was a pretty mundane draw, those three middle test matches which England won will certainly be etched in people's cricket consciousness forever.
And the iconography of it as well. The Edgbaston game, when I first saw that on the old VHS that my nan bought me, that really clinched it for me, because Headingley was miraculous, but there was a kind of, it was those Yorkshire cloudy, sort of slightly dank kind of atmosphere, but Edgbaston looked like it was 35 degrees, and the crowd, as you get at Edgbaston more than anywhere else probably in the country, the crowd was so into it. And I saw for the first time as a young kid that cricket could actually be exhilarating. I knew it could be interesting. I knew it could be tough. I didn't know it could be thrilling in that respect. And I think Botham's 5 for 1, he was riding on that kind of atmosphere there, it seemed.
When he got the ball and turned on this magic performance again, and some of the dismissals were pretty embarrassing. I think Martin Kent trying to hit a full-length ball through mid-wicket and getting bowled, and of course Lilly having a dramatic slog, and Marsh as well, and Bob Taylor taking the catch off Lilly at the second attempt.
That's it, yeah.
And then, Marsh and Lilly sort of belligerently walking off, and you could see that they were so anti-Kim Hughes that any bit of team spirit that was left in the Australian dressing room was quickly being dissipated by another embarrassing batting performance. It was great.
Yeah, just before the Old Trafford test, there's a little story from the brilliant Australian writer Christian Ryan, who wrote about the Kim Hughes story, and it's called Golden Boy, The Bad Old Days of Australian Cricket. And there's one particular story, an anecdote from there. They were staying in a London hotel between the two test matches, and Lilly and Hughes have a scrap, they have a fight, and it's towards the back end of an evening, and by the end of it they're basically down to their underpants and a vest, and they're both in that scenario, and they're both staggering back to the London hotel from whichever club or bar they've been at, having essentially kind of undressed each other in the midst of this fight, and then rather shamefacedly just sort of staggered back, heads bowed, back to their hotel room. So if ever you want just a little glimpse of how everything was collapsing all around them, then there's your image for you. Kim Hughes and Dennis Lilly walking along Putumwal or somewhere like that in their pants.
Well, I'm sure our Australian listeners are going to really enjoy some of these stories that the two of you are coming out with now. So it was then at Old Trafford that this Botham's great century and the series is wrapped up at that point. 3-1, England retained the Ashes, and what a summer of cricket it was. Just to finish on now, Bob, I mean, was this the most iconic Ashes series ever? I mean, for an Englishman.
Well, I guess the guys involved in it would like to say so, and probably in terms of, you know, a boy's comic, Roy of the Rover stuff, you couldn't have written a script that anyone would believe that this sort of turnaround could happen. I guess the 2005 series came pretty close. You know, the Edgbaston Test match of that series was one which nobody will forget either. But I think as a bunch of Test matches together, there was nothing quite like 1981. And a single hero like Botham really was the stuff of fairy tales. And I think that the lift it gave the country, it was similar in 2005, but I think people's sort of feelings in 2005 were a lot brighter during those times than the sort of dark days of 1981. So although I'm obviously biased, I'd like to say it was a very important factor in lifting the whole sort of psyche of the country.
Well, I think that rounds it off perfectly. Thanks for listening to this Ashes special podcast, the second episode in this three-part series in association with Wisden Cricket Monthly. This was 1981 Botham's Ashes with my guests Bob Willis and Phil Walker. In the next and final episode, we'll revisit Australia's dominance in the 1990s and England's resurgence since the 2005 home series. I'll be joined by former England bowler Simon Jones, journalist and writer Emma John, and Wisden Cricket Monthly's Joe Harmon to chew over all that. In the meantime, remember to subscribe and download the podcast from all the usual podcast providers. Episode 1, The Birth of the Urn and Bodyline, is already out. And for more information, head to lords.org/podcast.
You've been listening to the Lords Cricket Podcast, an Ashes special.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.